The headlines: Russia slams the European signatories to the JCPOA for their unconstructive approach and opposes any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the accord. A tragic milestone for the U.S., the COVID death toll hits 800,000. And also in our headlines, the World Health Organization warns Omicron is spreading at an unprecedented rate, urging countries to raise their shields. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour: Moscow says the stances of the European parties to the 2015 deal with Iran and the ongoing Vienna talks are surprising, unconstructive, and somewhat illogical, as if they were sitting at a negotiating table for the first time. Russia's representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, has made the remarks in an interview with Iran's Russian language, Pars Today. He believes that the Vienna talks are moving ahead slowly, with high chances of having a positive outcome. The Russian representative said the Iranian delegation is very serious with clear demands. He also praised Iran's draft proposals as a step forward. Ulyanov said Moscow is opposed to any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. According to Ulyanov, there are major obstacles to getting a guarantee from the U.S. that it won't withdraw from the deal again. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman tells Press TV that the discussions with the International Atomic Energy Agency have made progress. Said Khatibzadeh says talks between head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, and IAEA chief Rafael Grossi have narrowed gaps over several issues of mutual interest. Khatibzadeh says the two sides are expected to reach an understanding soon. The IAEA has been asking for access to a nuclear site that came under a sabotage attack in June. That's the centrifuge component manufacturing workshop at the Tesla Karaj complex. Iran says it will give the agency access to the site only if all the other parties to the 2015 agreement fulfill their obligations. Well, top UN official calls on the United States to lift sanctions on Iran and extend waivers regarding oil trade with the country amid the Vienna talks to revitalize the 2015 deal. UN Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo has called for waiver extensions to transfer enriched uranium out of the country in exchange for natural uranium. She said reaching an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks is the only option for the full and effective implementation of the JCPOA and Resolution 2231 that endorsed it. DiCarlo was briefing the Security Council on the implementation of the resolution. Speaking at the same session, Iran's UN Ambassador Majid Takht-Ravanchi explained Iran's stance on the revival of the 2015 accord.
When such customary and very fundamental principle of international law is mocked, trampled upon, and violated, no nation trusts the culprit, and so do we. Therefore, provision of verifiable and objective guarantees that the delicate balance of commitments will not be torpedoed anymore, the obligations will not be violated again, sanctions will not be reimposed under other pretexts or designations, as took place during the previous administration of the United States, and the JCPOA mechanism will not be abused, is absolutely necessary.
Takht-Ravanchi said Iran continues its remedial measures because other parties are not performing their obligations. He accused Washington of committing economic terrorism against Iran with actions that violate international law and the UN Charter. China's UN envoy also spoke at the meeting. He called for the removal of illegal and unilateral sanctions against Iran and said dialogue is the only path forward to resolve issues. The Russian envoy also weighed in on the ongoing talks in Vienna. He said the U.S. needs to show in action, rather than words, that it's willing to return to compliance with the JCPOA. In other news, rights groups are slamming the U.S. decision not to punish staff involved in a botched airstrike that killed civilians in Afghanistan. The American Civil Liberties Union says it's disappointed over the outcome of the Pentagon's investigation into the late August drone strike. A group, Nutrition and Education International, says such decisions send a dangerous message that the deadly attack was justified. Advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow is calling for an international investigation, noting that the U.S. can't hold itself accountable. The Pentagon says that its probe found no violation of the law. Washington has called the drone strike a tragic mistake. It says a civilian target was mistaken for a Daesh terrorist preparing to attack U.S. forces and diplomats. The strike killed 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. We've asked political commentator Sarah Flounders to comment on the issue. She says the international community must hold Washington accountable for the crimes U.S. troops committed in Afghanistan.
This is U.S. policy. Thousands and thousands of drone attacks. And again, it's been exposed as overwhelmingly attacks on civilians. And the response of the U.S. has been to jail anyone who has exposed these crimes. In Afghanistan, because by then U.S. troops were on their way out the door, they couldn't suppress the story. But it's not the first time it's come up, as Daniel Hale, who's now serving 4 years in prison, exposed thousands of drone attacks. We know that the U.S. is unaccountable, even though they directly, with a drone attack, assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian major general on a peace mission to Iraq a year ago this month. So U.S. crimes, particularly with drone warfare, continues unrelenting. There's no accountability ever in these attacks. The one in Afghanistan was just horrendous. So there should be a demand for accountability. There should be charges of war crimes for the firing of these Hellfire missiles at the press of a button. But we shouldn't expect that the United States will ever respond to these acts that they are so criminally have carried out.
The United States hits a grim milestone in its fight against the COVID pandemic, with the number of deaths in the country now passing the 800,000 mark. The data from Johns Hopkins University represents the highest reported toll of any country in the world. Most deaths have been recorded among the unvaccinated and the elderly. The U.S. reached 50 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 2 days ago. The alarming surge in deaths comes as the world is bracing for a rise in cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization warning that it's spreading at an unprecedented rate.
77 countries have now reported cases of Omicron, and the reality is that Omicron is probably in most countries, even if it hasn't been detected yet. Omicron is spreading at a rate we have not seen with any previous variant.
The WHO chief said many countries are rolling out their booster shots, warning of a repeat of vaccine hoarding and inequity. You know that there are many people who have not received a single jab yet. Omicron was first detected in November. It was it rather has a large number of mutations. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests that Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade immunity from vaccination. The United Arab Emirates says it will withdraw from talks to acquire billions of dollars worth of advanced U.S. weaponry. Abu Dhabi says it has made the decision due to technical requirements and sovereign operational restrictions. This means that the UAE will no longer be receiving the 50 F-35 fighter jets and nearly 20 armed drones it was hoping to acquire. Washington says it's still committed to the sales of the aircraft to the Arab country. Abu Dhabi's decision comes amid disagreements with Washington over its relationship with China. It also comes days after the United Arab Emirates struck a multi-billion dollar agreement with France for the purchase of 80 Rafale warplanes. The United Arab Emirates' reception of the Israeli Prime Minister has been met with anger. Palestinians say Abu Dhabi is betraying their cause by normalizing its relations with the regime. They're also calling for the expulsion of the UAE from the Arab League. Iran has also condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the UAE as detrimental to regional security.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S.-brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli prime minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel.
The UAE claims the normalization will enable it to mediate between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but that hasn't been helpful at all considering Israel's 11-day deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip in May. Months after Tel Aviv normalized its ties with Abu Dhabi, Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians on an almost daily basis also raise questions about the real intentions behind the normalization.
The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ebrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as the root cause of problems in the region.
So now all of this is U.S. policy. And it's going to continue to be U.S. policy. And that's why their vassal states in the Middle East, these Arab monarchies that have no authority, really, to rule, except by because of European colonialism and Western imperialism, they do what they're told.
Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
In the UK, the Islamic Human Rights Council based in London has held an Islamophobia Awareness Conference, bringing together scholars and witnesses of discrimination to discuss the way forward for Muslims everywhere. Bianca Ragni has more from London.
Islamophobia is everywhere, making news on a regular basis. From the US,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
To the halls of power in Europe.
Do I have a problem with Islam? Yes, I do have a problem with Islam.
Recently, this made headlines. Lauren Boebert joking about meeting fellow Congressman Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is. Ilhan Omar. Oops. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine.
Muslim minorities everywhere are discussing solutions to the crisis. At the Islamophobia Awareness Conference organized by the Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London, the panel asked how much Muslim minorities can engage with their non-Muslim governments without compromising their faith.
Is our position one where we should engage in a kind of pragmatic way to just the ends justify the means? Or rather, do we follow, for theological reasons, a principled approach?
I would say, from my perspective, it's vital for diasporas, Muslim diasporas, the Ummah across the world, African and Caribbean diasporas, you have to engage.
Muslims are often forced to pledge allegiance to Western values in an overtly violent way. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. So refusing to do this can be powerful.
The depoliticization of mosques and the younger generation is a major concern. Efforts to prevent young people seeking justice and fighting oppression have intensified, raising the alarm.
There is a deliberate attempt to social engineer a type of Muslim which will not speak out, will be just obedient servant, will fit into the second-class citizenship which we all know is being promoted.
We asked conference moderator Professor Saeed Khan why such events matter.
Conferences like this are ones that help to then map out what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's a wrap for now, but do stay tuned up.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
plants grow and give fruits and flowers when they are in the most ideal circumstances. Proper amount of sun, water, soil conditions, and the right temperature are all the ingredients for a happy plant to grow and do what it does best. These days, being a successful farmer is a much more complicated and demanding profession than in the past. Farmers today not only need to have great agricultural skills, but they also must have exceptional technological and marketing expertise. And the most recent trend in farming are greenhouses.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. In this program, we will explore new developments in Iran's vast agriculture industry while shining the spotlight on greenhouses. We wanted to see what all the fanfare is about with this type of farming. Plus, we will also check out how it's making profits in the agriculture sector. So plant yourself in a comfortable seat and let's start the show.
Our journey began at Farakishte Parsian. This company has been around for decades and has a rich history of activity in livestock rearing and farming. Some years ago, it launched a new business specializing in high-tech hydroponic greenhouses. It's an indoor farm with greenhouses built on many hectares of land. Mainly, it grows three types of produce and the variety of tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce. Each year, it may focus on growing a single type of crop, such as peppers. They have perfected Mother Nature indoors through a combination of science and technology married with farming. The goal is to provide sustainable indoor farming solutions that optimize the use of natural resources. Hydroponic greenhouses grow crops in nutrient-rich water, so water management is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce, and they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult.
As you might know, open land farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spots, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. the agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also was a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials.
The Ministry of Agriculture defines several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few. Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was barely impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing, promotion, and distribution. Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports. When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
We will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasajan Parse Mehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day.
Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines to work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other steps, it is fed to a machine for pulling. Each step requires accuracy and precision to make high-quality threads.
The beating heart of this company is the quality control unit. Here, threads are tested for their strength and uniformity based on specifications of its productions. The results are then grouped into three categories based on their quality. The highest grades are then packaged and released into the market. Because of Iran's strategic geographical location, this company easily exports its products to Turkey and competes with other big exporters, such as China and India. This manufacturer's main claim to fame is the high quality of its thread. With such large productions, this company is eyeing the expansion of its production facilities. It has already implemented a second phase of production expansion, and the feasibility study for the third phase is in the works. These developments offer numerous investment opportunities as well. Most of the raw material needed to make polyester threads are domestically produced, with the exception of the spin finishes. The majority of finishes need to be imported. These oils are used because of their properties for increasing thread performance and processability of polyester yarns. These features add value to threads, which makes spin finishes a vital ingredient in the production mix. However, the U.S. imposed sanctions have made importing this item difficult over the years.
Polyester has gained a significant role in the textile industry. Some 50 years ago, cotton was the most important fiber in this industry. But over the years, this changed. Population growth meant prioritizing food crops, which decreased the area for cotton cultivation. So demand for polyester fibers grew such that it is now called the king of fibers in the textile industry.
At present, the most important raw material in the textile industry is polyester. It dominates 60% of material used in the textile production cycle. This is followed by cotton and then a small amount of other natural fibers, such as wool and silk. Other synthetic fibers, such as acrylic, nylon, and polypropylene, are also used in this industry, among others. The main raw material used to make polyester threads are granules, which are produced in large amounts in the petrochemical industry. Domestic polyester granule production is dominated by a handful of companies with a combined annual production of over 420,000 tons. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. This amount is largely set for the making of polyester threads and is said to be enough for domestic needs. The petrochemical industry also produces other granules, which are used across almost all industrial sectors. Last year, Iran's total thread production stood at around 48,000 tons. 25% of the raw material used in this production was from cotton. That's based on figures from the National Textile Association. The country makes a lot of cotton, but it is still not nearly enough to meet demands. The domestic demand is roughly around 120,000 tons of cotton annually. This is why local productions last year stood at around 60,000 tons.
Polyester is derived from polymers made by the petrochemical industry. It's not surprising that Iran's polymer industry is exponentially expanding given its large oil reserves. various manufacturing sectors, such as the textile industry, plastics, and even automobile industry, are heavily dependent on petrochemical products. So how are productions in this sector doing?
Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. That's based on statistics from the National Plastics and Polymer Industrial Association. Of this amount, some 3 million tons of raw material are exported with a value of $3 billion. The other half of total productions is domestically used to make added value products. These items include polyester string, fabrics, tires, dishes, and containers, and a whole lot more. In total, the association puts the combined exports of petrochemical and polymer products at around $12 billion. Iran's Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union predicts an increase in added value of petrochemical products. The union estimates products made from petchems will reach a value of $18 billion in exports by the end of this year. The government has implemented policies and initiatives to increase added value through industries that use these raw materials. All in all, there are numerous opportunities in this sector and the ever-growing textile industry. It is an industry that has built a bridge between past and present with an eye on the future.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
We live in a world where our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones. We transfer money, we call our friends, and we do our shopping using these two magic numbers that form the foundation of the virtual yet real world that's called IT. Today, I'll walk you around this Iranian company that has a lot to say when it comes to the IT sector.
Here, only the impossible is impossible. This is the motto which Ida Bonyane Moftaker Pars has set its targets on. The Iranian brand develops a range of IT and ICT products, from apps and websites to educational content. The idea of launching such a business was developed more than a decade and a half ago in the mind of its CEO when he was just a high school student.
E-commerce is one of the amazing outcomes of the digital space. The emergence of online shopping has provided an instant link between customers and sellers, where customers can easily window shop and get their hands on their desired items in a tap of a finger.
Minikala is the name of a newbie online shopping app that's developed by the thriving brand. In less than 2 years, the number of Minikala users is rapidly approaching 500K. Ida Bonyane Moptakere Pars is an umbrella company that has under its belt a range of startups producing apps with different purposes, from money management apps to shopping and medical applications. This is what makes this firm stand out from the ever-growing number of rivals in Iran.
Despite its adverse effect on the global economy, when it comes to digital marketing, the coronavirus pandemic was a blessing, making the online space the safest possible channel for people to get their hands on different products. And this company says it fares even better during the pandemic. Many companies went bankrupt, almost bankrupt, during the coronavirus pandemic. But when it comes to the online shopping and the digital marketing, it was a blessing in disguise.
With a dedicated team bringing together more than 150 highly driven programmers, Moptaker says it tries to expand the scope of its activity based on the needs of the day. Otherwise, it would stay behind in the fast-paced market.
The IT sector is an ever-growing industry, and it requires businesses to catch up with the latest trends in the industry.
Many thanks for that awesome report. All right then, we're almost out of time for this show, but before we go, let's check out some trends and developments in the country's agriculture sector. One of the biggest concerns for most farmers is how to best control pests. Now, an Iranian developer has used nanotechnology to formulate a pesticide.
This nanopesticide, which is biodegradable and biocompatible, kills pests without causing environmental contamination. The developer says this product can be used on pistachio, citrus trees, cotton, sugar beets, and other plants as well. Many synthesized pesticides used around the world in agriculture can throw the natural ecosystem off balance. They not only kill off the pests, but also valuable insects and organisms that help combat pests. Nanopesticides are being hailed as an emerging technology that will minimize the harmful effects of pesticides on people and the environment.
As you might already know, the right amount of water is critical in getting high crop yields. One of the ways that the government manages water resources in agriculture is by implementing modern irrigation systems.
In Ardabil province, nearly 5,000 hectares of farmland was fitted with updated irrigation systems. Provincial officials are planning to increase this amount to 15,000 hectares by the end of this year. Upgrading farmland irrigation methods is part of a program outlined by the Ministry of Agriculture. Feasibility studies for this project show it will increase irrigation efficiency by 44%, and production capacity is expected to rise by 30% with optimized irrigation. The program director says 150,000 hectares of land now have modern irrigation across Iran.
The agriculture industry is massive, and the scope of it doesn't really sink in until there's an opportunity to visit an agriculture trade show such as the one that was kicked off in the capital city of Tehran.
Some 150 companies participated in this exhibition. Businesses showcased their latest achievements in the field of irrigation, animal feed, greenhouses, and agricultural mechanization. This is the sixth year the exhibition is being held at the International Fairgrounds. It is a platform where industry participants can connect with researchers and technology developers. The event covers several thematic sections, such as horticulture, aquaculture, and processing and packing, among others.
And that wraps up our show for today. Don't forget to leave your feedback. Also, you can share your thoughts and comments with us through our email. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at the right of the child in previous episodes, and obviously that is through the understanding of Amir al-Mu'mineen wa Sayyid al-Muwahideen al-Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful himself. There are many rights of a child that we need to give to him. Obviously, that's through the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Among these rights, the right of upbringing. Now, among the essential rights of a child that needs to be given to him is giving him the proper, adequate upbringing, because it is a mean and it is a tool for him to grow and build his identity and reach his goals. And not only that, but also contribute to society and contribute at least to the Islamic world and to the Islamic Ummah, if not to humanity in general. He needs to contribute. We need to have people who are ready to give back to the society. We don't want to create just consumers that they just eat and sleep. We have plenty of those. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, when it comes to knowledge, when it comes to worship, when it comes to responsibility, when it comes to setting goals, all these things need to be taught to a child. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, for example, first he says this responsibility falls on the parents. And he says in one of his sayings, he says, Rahimallahu walidan a'ana wilduhu ala birra. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have mercy on those parents who help their children to become good to them. Because if you bring your child correctly, obviously he's going to be kind and gentle to you. If you don't, he wouldn't be. And he wouldn't be good to you, and then he will be considered to be Islamically aq, a bad son or a bad daughter. And then obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to accept their actions, then they're going to end up going to hellfire, God forbid. So we as parents, we need to help our children, give them the proper upbringing so they could be good. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says that when it comes to your child, he has a right upon you. How, ya Amir al-Mu'mineen? He says, حَقُّ الْوَلَدُ عَلَى الْوَالِدِ, the right of a child on his parents are a few things. One, he says, يُحْسِنُ isma. You have to give him a proper name. A proper name. And naming plays a big role on the child's mind. And that has been proven in our modern day studies, that they said the name of the child plays a big role when it comes to his personality. Whatever his name is, it will usually contribute to his actions. So that's one. And then he says it, وَيُحْسُنُ أَدَبَ, that he gives him proper education. Proper education, not just any education. Not that you throw him in school and wait for him to come to you a prophet. That's not going to happen. That requires a bit of effort from the parents. School itself is not going to do the job. The parents need to do more than that for their children. And three, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says, as a right of a child, he says, وَيُعَلِّمُهُ الْقُرْآنِ, that you need to teach him the Qur'an. So three rights of the child that needs to be given to him. One, to give him a proper name. Two, to give him a proper upbringing. And three, that you need to teach him the Qur'an. Whether you teach him or someone else is teaching him, or you bring him a teacher, nevertheless, as long as you get to teach him the Qur'an. Now, let us take a short break, then inshallah we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So the hadith we looked at before where Amir al-Mu'mineen defines the three rights of a child. So basically what Amir al-Mu'mineen is doing, he said the right of the child comes into stages. The first stage after birth, where his identity gets created and gets formed. And through this stage, you know, you need to give him the proper name, which will leave, obviously, big effect on him, as we said. The second stage of a child's life is for him, you know, during his ages of being, when he understands and his brain is receptive to information and to understanding, that's when he requires what? To be taught all these good things. So also that is an important factor. And a third stage is after he becomes a mature, where he requires Islamic laws and requires to learn his Quran, because it is the constitution of a Muslim. If a person is far away from the Quran, obviously everything else is not going to be as strong. So you can see that even though there are three things, but in Amir al-Mu'mineen's words, there are pretty much three stages that one needs to look at. So, for example, even when it comes to Quran, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he takes that into he gives it more attention. He says, وَإِنْ عَلَّمَهُ الْقُرْآنَ دُعِيَ الْأَبَوَانِ فَكُسِيَ حَلَّتَيْنِ يُضَاءَ نُرُهُمَا وُجُوهَ أَهْلِ الْجَنَّةِ. He says, when the parent teaches the children Quran, on the day of judgment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will clothe his parents with clothes of light, luminous light. Now, how that light is beyond our comprehension. He says, with clothing of lights that it will shine, their faces will shine and illuminate to the people of heaven. Now, just by teaching a child Quran, because literally what you're doing is you're giving him a protection in this world from evil, from sins, from bad, and you know, from bad morals and vices. Where in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala shall reward you for your efforts. And that child himself, he's taught correctly. Not only that you've saved him in this world, but also you've made him move towards the right direction, in the right path, and they end up what? Going to heaven, inshallah. So you save this child from both aspects. So when it comes to the child and his upbringing and us teaching him Islamically, teaching him Quran and teaching him all the things that he requires, this is a right, which means something that needs to be given, something that needs to be maintained. We're not doing them a favor. I always keep repeating that word. It's not a favor when I teach my child. It's not a favor when I'm trying to bring him a teacher or an educator. It's not a favor when I'm taking him to school. It's not a favor when I'm trying to provide and sustain him. These, in fact, are his basic needs and rights that I need to give to him as a father. And even me, at some stage, I required these things from my father, and they were also compulsory and required from him. And my kids, when they grow older, they will do the same thing. So we're not doing anyone a favor. So we need to take the right of the child quite seriously. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu bil alamin, wa ala ahil nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim tarjuka ahsin khatmina.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.